We begin today with a look at how social media is affecting the way we learn about war. If you haven't seen for yourself how Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook have revolutionized the way the media does its job, you cannot miss it now. We're also seeing more information, photos, and videos than ever from activists, aid workers, and even what we might call ordinary people who happen to be on the front lines of conflict. This was underscored last week when Israeli forces bombed a fishing shack on a Gaza pier, and then struck again as young boys ran across the beach. When the smoke cleared, four boys were dead. Journalists at a hotel across the street witnessed and tweeted the whole thing. There was also a viral video showing an Israeli wedding party running and screaming as a Hamas missile was blown up overhead by Israel's Iron Dome defense system. But as you might imagine, this conflict, among many others, stirs up very strong opinions around the world. Some are questioning whether social media helps or harms accuracy when reporting on conflict. We wanted to talk about this, so we're joined now by Anne Bernard, a New York Times correspondent in Gaza City. She's been covering the Middle East, including Syria's civil war, for a number of years now. Anne, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Also joining us from Geneva is Peter Bucart, Emergencies Director for Human Rights Watch, the human rights organization. As part of his work, Peter has investigated alleged war crimes in Syria, Sri Lanka, and the Central African Republic. Peter, welcome to you as well. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And I'm going to start with you because you're on the ground reporting on this current conflict in Gaza. Is there anything you want to tell us about the situation right now?
Well, today there's continued fighting in the east of Gaza. More than 100,000 people have fled their homes, and even though they've been told to move west, there's also an intensifying air campaign even in downtown Gaza City. So people are fleeing, and they're still getting hit in the places they've fled. So it's a very chaotic situation.
As I mentioned, you are an experienced, very distinguished reporter for the New York Times, which is a veteran kind of legacy news organization. You also bring along your Twitter followers for real-time updates of news while you're out reporting, just like we are doing now. You did this after the fall of Hamas in Syria and over the past few days in Gaza. How do you decide what to tweet out?
Well, as a practical matter, sometimes we're just constrained by the situation. We don't have data on our mobiles when we're out and about, so we can't tweet live from the field. But I do think Twitter gives us more immediacy. So when I'm tweeting, live in a war zone, I'm just going to be tweeting what's in front of me. And it might be a little more personal, how it feels in a certain place, how I reacted to something. For instance, I tweeted about a girl who we saw die in the hospital. She didn't have any relatives around her, and so we couldn't find out her name. And we actually watched the moment of her death and her being pronounced dead. And both my colleague and I actually cried, and we decided to tweet about it. And she struck me as being something like an unknown soldier, although she was a civilian. So in my tweet, I described the scene and I said she was the unknown civilian. Mm. And that's not really something I would write in a news story, but it's been retweeted, thousands of times. So I think it strikes a nerve because people feel like they're getting a postcard from another human being who is experiencing something far away.
Does anybody vet your tweets, for example, in the way that you wouldn't post something and nothing would be published in the Times without an editor having put his or her eyes on it first? Does anybody kind of vet your tweets or put their eyes on it first just to say, gee, Anne, do you really want to say that or anything like that? Or are you your own editor in this situation?
In this situation, they rely on our judgment. I mean, we have to be aware of not crossing a line, just the way we would in the paper.
Peter, what about you? As we mentioned, your work with Human Rights Watch has brought you to the Central African Republic and Syria. And what do you decide to tweet out or to put out on social media? What's the standard for you?
Well, one of our big jobs at Human Rights Watch is to try to draw attention to crises which are underreported. So I spent a lot of the last year in the Central African Republic live tweeting the conflict that was happening there, a very brutal conflict between the Muslim and the Christian community. And we managed to get a lot of attention to the conflict by using social media when the normal media was not really present on the ground. But the real challenge is to tweet information which is reliable. And I have a rule of thumb that I always read the tweet 3 times before I send it out. Because it is a very immediate way to communicate. And we have a reputation for reliability, both as the New York Times and as Human Rights Watch, that we want to keep. So we do have to take great care to use the same standards when we're tweeting than when we're reporting or investigating these kind of abuses.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the role that social media like Twitter and YouTube and Facebook play in conflict zones around the world. We're speaking about this with Peter Bouchard. He's Emergencies Director for Human Rights Watch. That's a human rights organization. Also with us, Anne Bernard, New York Times correspondent. She's currently reporting in Gaza. Talking about fact-finding, you know, I think a lot of people in the U.S. remember, for example, from the Boston Marathon bombings, that inaccurate rumors spread very quickly. Let's assume that some of these people were well-meaning because they thought that they were helping law enforcement. They thought they were kind of helping, you know, pin down, you know, vital information that needed to get out to the public. But a lot of this stuff was just wrong. And so I wanted to ask if, Anne, maybe you want to start, has that ever happened to you? Is there any check that you imposed to be sure that that does not happen? And is there, are you called upon, for example, to respond to those kinds of rumors coming from other sources?
Well, I think on occasion, yes, I have knocked down tweets that I've seen that I know to be untrue or unreliable. But that's not really my job. My job is to be responsible for my own reporting.
I wanted to ask, though, when I was a reporter for The Wall Street Journal and was based at the White House, I found myself spending an inordinate amount of time exactly that, chasing down other people's rumors, because, you know, there are obviously motivated players who have an interest in promoting false information for their own agenda. And, you know, that could have taken up my entire day. And I just wondered, Anne, if chasing down other people's false information, does that take up space in your brain that it didn't, for example, 5 years ago or 10 years ago?
Well, it certainly does in the Syria conflict. That's a case where it's very hard to access the front lines. Sometimes it's hard even to access the back lines because the government has a very strict visa regime and the rebel-held areas pose a very high kidnapping threat for foreign journalists. So social media has been an invaluable tool, but it's just one tool. And so we do have to keep in mind that there are motivated players on both sides, and there have been many instances where pictures have been tweeted that, you know, you can easily just search on Google Images and find that that image is old or from another time or even from another place. So, yes, there is some amount of time that we spend verifying that information, but in a way, it's a good thing to have more information, and you just have to be selective about how you use it.
Peter, what about you? I mean, some people have said that, you know, the information age is like perpetually trying to drink water from a fire hose, that your whole purpose in what you do is to try to draw attention to things that people are not paying attention to. Are you finding that easier or harder with social media?
It is hard work verifying some of this information. But if I can just use the example of the Ghouta chemical attack last year, we were able to use social media to establish that the Syrian government was the most likely culprit of that attack. And that's not just looking at tweets and reporting them. It means tracing back who is posting this information and then speaking to them and asking them to send us additional information. In that case, we had activists sending us pictures of the actual missiles which were used in the chemical attack. We used satellite imagery, as we did last month, to confirm mass executions claimed by ISIS in Tikrit. So we have been able to use social media not just to get our message out, but also as a research tool.
Do you feel that your priority is documenting abuses by governmental entities or by all parties? And do you feel, you know, an equal responsibility, or do you feel that you need to project through your social media presence an even-handedness or not?
Absolutely. In all of the conflicts that Human Rights Watch works in, we investigate abuses by all sides, by Hamas and by the Israeli army in the case of Gaza. We have to focus on the abuses by both sides. And I think one of the most frustrating parts for all of us working on social media is the incredible insensitivity of people tweeting back to us, justifying these kind of crimes, whether it's, you know, people saying death to Arabs, or justifying abuses on the other side. It really is horrendous just to get these very awful and often racist messages on both sides of the conflict, because that's another dark side of social media.
And Peter, just to speak to that, yesterday that was so intense for me that I finally tweeted out, listen, people, if you're going to tweet anti-Arab, anti-Jewish, or anti-Muslim tweets, please just take me off your thread. And that tweet was also retweeted many times.
I was going to ask you about that, and that's actually where I was going to go next, is that reporters working in war zones have always been, you know, by definition, it's dangerous work. And I just wondered whether you felt that social media in some ways exposes you to more risk because people are aware of where you are in real time and are tempted to influence your thinking or to threaten you.
Yes. When I do receive threats, I report them to Twitter, and oftentimes I confront the people and they take the tweets down. Sometimes people don't realize that they're talking to a human being until they stop and think, you know. Also, I do try to say, for instance, I don't tweet in real time my location, either in Syria or here. In part, that's, as I said, because of technical problems, but it's also because I don't want to endanger not just myself, but the people I'm talking to. So usually I tweet once I've moved away from the place.
So this is here to stay. Anne, is that really kind of the, forgive me for being, you know, pedestrian about it, but this is, the social media presence is here to stay. There is no going back, I take it.
I don't think so. I think overall it brings more benefits than problems. I think we just, again, we have to remember that our primary work is the reporting we're doing on the ground. Our job isn't to tweet in real time. I've had people harassing me on Twitter saying, why haven't you tweeted this? Why haven't you tweeted that? And it's like, well, because I'm working.
That was Anne Bernard, Mideast correspondent with The New York Times, with us from Gaza. Peter Bucart is Emergencies Director at Human Rights Watch, with us from Geneva, Switzerland. Thank you both for being with us, and we thank you both so much for taking the time during these very busy days.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to spend much of the rest of this program today talking about issues in parenting. In a few minutes, our parenting roundtable will take on the issue of when to step in if you think a child is in danger. As you might imagine, we're talking about this because there have been a number of stories about parents being arrested for things like leaving a child in a park unattended when another parent believes the child to be in danger. But first, we're going to focus on how the workplace treats expectant parents. For years, expectant mothers and advocates have complained that laws protecting pregnant women have not been clear or consistently enforced. But now the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC, has stepped in. The agency has data showing that pregnancy-related discrimination complaints rose 46% between 1997 and 2011. So this month, the EEOC updated their enforcement guidance on pregnancy discrimination for the first time in decades. We wanted to hear more about this, so we've called Emily Martin, the Vice President and General Counsel at the National Women's Law Center. We are not related to our knowledge. Emily, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Also with us is Bridget Schulte, who's written about the new EEOC guidelines for the Washington Post. Back with us once again. Bridget, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what exactly do these new EEOC guidelines call for? What do they do?
Well, what they really do is clarify what workers can expect and what employers can reasonably offer their workers to accommodate them. Say if you're a pregnant worker, sometimes you will have diabetes. You'll need more water. Sometimes your doctor will say you shouldn't lift heavy things. That could be sort of a physical impairment, or you shouldn't stand so long. So a reasonable accommodation would be, say, carry around a water bottle, or take light duty if you have sort of a physically demanding job.
So does it change the legal definition of pregnancy? How pregnancy is viewed under the law? Does it change that?
Well, it doesn't change the view of pregnancy as much as what it does is it says that if a worker is able to work, you have to give them a reasonable accommodation. You have to be willing to work with them. Whereas in the legal landscape has been very confusing over the years. And right now there's a big Supreme Court case that centers on the question of, do you accommodate workers only who have been injured on the job or who have been injured off the job? And then that's where pregnancy comes in, because you really can't argue that pregnancy is an on-the-job disability.
Let's talk a little bit more about the legal aspects of that in a minute. But Emily, before we do, I want to ask you to kind of help me understand kind of the legal issues here. But because your organization, one of its missions is to advocate for pregnant workers, what are some of the complaints that you've been hearing?
Well, we hear a lot of complaints from women who are denied really the simplest changes at work when they need them because of pregnancy. Even when employers provide those sorts of accommodations, if someone needs it because of a bad back or some other disease or injury. So, for example, we've heard from women who work as cleaners and who have to lift heavy trash bags a couple times a day, who were told you have to go out on unpaid leave because even though we accommodate disabilities and we accommodate on-the-job injuries, we don't accommodate pregnancy. And that means that women have to go on to unpaid leave, often relatively early in their pregnancies, and use it all up before the baby's even born, at which point they can lose their job.
What is the hinge of these guidelines that are changed? Does the law still recognize pregnancy as a disability? Or what does it actually do? Does it redefine what's considered reasonable? Because I'm guessing that that's what employers are arguing about, that they're arguing about whether something is a reasonable accommodation or not. I can envision a scenario where somebody might say, well, lifting those bags is your job, and if you can't do that job, then you can't be here.
There are a couple key things that the EEOC guidelines clarify under current law. So one thing the EEOC did was make clear that the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, requires employers to make accommodations for employees with disabilities, including pregnancy-related disabilities. So if you have gestational diabetes or if you have pregnancy-related carpal tunnel syndrome and that's the reason that you can't perform some part of your job, that you have a disability under the ADA, and the employer has to make a reasonable accommodation. Now, what's reasonable depends on the particular job and the particular employer, but that's an important clarification because a lot of employers thought pregnancy is not a disability, so if it's related to pregnancy, we don't have an obligation.
I want to hear a little bit more about also if it affects fathers in a minute, but Bridget, I wanted to ask you, you've been reporting on this, both sides of this question. What have employers said to you about this?
Well, you know, you hear different things from different employers. You know, in the white-collar world, what was very interesting is talking with employment lawyers, and what they'll say is that pregnancy discrimination tends to be very overt, but in more of a blue-collar setting. When I've talked with, say, the general counsel of the EEOC, he said it shocks him sometimes how, particularly in a blue-collar or a low-wage setting, how overt it is. In one case, he said a judge had said, where's the plaintiff? Isn't that the woman who should be home with her children? So that there are some very hard and fast views about the role of women that come into play there. In the white-collar world, what you end up running into is there have been cases where employers have asked women, do you plan to get pregnant again? And they'll say yes, and then they'll find themselves sort of sidetracked, their direct reports taken away.
And that's not allowed. That's not permitted. Those kinds of questions are not permitted. But I note that the guidelines were updated on a 3-2 vote. Why is that? If there's such a bright line, why was the decision to update these guidelines so divided?
It was a divided vote, largely along political lines. And the reasoning that the Republican-appointed commissioners gave is that this hadn't gone through a public vetting process, so there were some process questions. There is a Supreme Court case that's pending, and they felt that this kind of came too early, that the EEOC was overreaching, so that there was a disagreement about process in there.
Emily, do these guidelines only affect women? For example, that there are some companies that do offer paternity leave. Are fathers affected by this? I mean, they don't experience the physical manifestations of pregnancy, at least so far as we know, although there's some interesting research that suggests that they do experience some physical changes. But are fathers affected by this?
One of the things that the guidelines say is that if an employer offers parental leave over and above the leave that you are entitled to recover from the actual physical effects of childbirth, that parental leave has to be equally available to fathers and to mothers, that you can't give 3 months of leave to mothers and 2 weeks of leave to fathers. And in many ways, actually, all of the pregnancy discrimination guidelines affect fathers too, because when women are losing their jobs because they're pregnant, that impacts the whole family. So in many ways, this is a family issue, not just a women's issue in every circumstance.
Bridget, what else do you want to report on this? What else is interesting to you about this area? I think that, you know, people will react to this in different ways. Some people will find this very sort of surprising and appalling. And I think other people will also react and believe that this kind of is in conflict with, you know, biology as they understand it. What else is interesting to you about this?
Well, you know, to be perfectly honest, it shocked me that in 2014, I'm even reporting on these kinds of things, that people get fired because their doctor says that they need water bottles to walk around with water bottles, that they get fired or they lose their jobs because they need a stool. They can still do their jobs. They just need to sit. That there aren't accommodations that you can throw at your back at a golf golf game over the weekend if you're a guy, but that you may not necessarily get those same accommodations if you're pregnant. So I think what surprises me is that we're talking about it at all.
Bridget Schulte is a reporter for The Washington Post. She's the author of Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. She was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios, along with Emily Martin, who's the vice president and general counsel at the National Women's Law Center. And once again, I don't believe that we are related. Thank you, Emily.
Thank you,
Bridget.
Thanks so much.
Now we'll hear from a man who's been overcoming bias and doubts for his entire life. Spencer West was born with a genetic disorder that affected his legs. Minutes after he was born, a physician told his parents he would probably never walk, and by the age of 5, both of his legs had been amputated. But he spent a lifetime challenging himself and challenging the way people think about physical disability. In the past year, West completed a 300-kilometer trek across Canada in a wheelchair and on his hands. And a few years ago, at the age of 31, he climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, the tallest peak in Africa, using his arms and hands. We wanted to revisit my 2012 conversation with Spencer West about his memoir, Standing Tall, My Journey, and I started by asking him why he didn't want to use prosthetic legs.
It just seemed silly. People knew that I didn't have legs. I knew that I didn't have legs, so why should I pretend like I did? And it was so much easier for me to get around on my hands in my wheelchair that it just seemed silly, and it seemed like a lie to wear them, to be honest.
And when you say that it seemed so much easier, let me just give an example of some of the things that you were doing as a kid. Swimming. You're part of your high school cheerleading squad and actually participated in statewide competitions. Wow.
Thank you.
I have to say, some of the things I've seen you do these things in videos, and there are a lot of things that people with two legs can't do.
Well, you know, I think it's like anything. With a lot of practice and some determination, I think anything is possible.
Well, you write over and over again in your book that you had a great advantage. Well, actually, you had two great advantages, your mom and your dad. Tell us a little bit more about that.
They never treated me like I was different. You know, my mom said, you know, Spencer, we were afraid if something were to happen to your dad and I that you wouldn't be able to take care of yourself. And if we started to treat you differently, you would think you were different and you wouldn't take the risks you needed to become your own person. And it's really my two parents that set the foundation for me to do the things that I've done, like you said, like cheerleading, like going to college and, you know, traveling overseas.
From the very beginning where people were telling them what you should not do or what you could not do or what you'd never be able to do, things like, oh, well, he should be prepared for a sedentary career, so they should encourage his, you know, interest in reading and things like that because he's never going to be able to do X, Y, and Z. They never listened. What gave them the courage to just not listen?
You know, I sometimes feel bad about that we wrote that because I don't want to vilify the doctors in any way. They didn't know what to do with me, and so they were giving us their best case. But, you know, my parents are really great at, like, no, we've seen what he can do already, and we just don't believe that.
And I don't think you're mean about it at all. I completely take your point. And that, I think, exemplifies a very generous spirit that you have. But there was some bullying. Totally. Do you mind talking about that?
The simple one is being in school and going to gym class every day and having to watch two team captains pick person after person to be on a team until I was the only one left. In middle school, you know, there was one student in particular, and again, I don't think he meant for this to happen, but I was going down the hall and he grabbed the back of my wheelchair just as a joke, and I stopped abruptly, and, you know, my books fell on the floor, and then I tumbled out after them. And, you know, he did lean in to help me, but he didn't know what to do, and he got scared, and he ran away. You know, I'm left laying on the ground while students are continuing to walk by to go to their classrooms. And you know, and then the emphasis in sports in high school, you know, I sort of felt like I wasn't a well-rounded student unless I played a sport. And so that's why I wanted to become a cheerleader, to prove that just because I didn't have any legs doesn't mean that I couldn't play a sport either. I was good academically. So fine, I'm going to show you that I can be an athlete too.
Then in 2008, you had another experience that was kind of life-changing for you. You went on a volunteer trip to Kenya where you helped build a school in a rural town. And I actually get a kick out of the picture that there is of you with holding a brick over your head and you're saying, it's not going to build itself, people. But what made you want to go and what did you get out of that experience?
Well, you know, I had graduated from college with a bachelor's in communication and I got into the real world and I just wasn't satisfied with material possessions and money. I felt really sort of cheated by society. I thought these were the things I was told that I needed, and now that I had them, I still wasn't happy. And so a friend of mine invited me to go on a volunteer trip to Kenya to help build a school for an organization based out of Canada called Free the Children. it was the first time that I'd really seen poverty firsthand. It was the first time that I'd seen international development that was sustainable and actually working and breaking the cycle of poverty. And the moment that changed my life forever is when we arrived at the Free the Children schools and, you know, 300 kids came running out and circled around me. And they literally asked me everything. You know, where was I from? How did I get here? Where were my legs? Did I leave them in the United States? And after I answered all their questions, a young girl said to me that she didn't know something like this, meaning the loss of my legs, could happen to white people too. You know, that one phrase fundamentally changed the entire course of my life. I didn't realize there was value to my story, and I didn't realize that I could actually use it to inspire other people to recognize that, you know, if I can overcome my obstacles, what more can we do every single day as individuals, whether we're in Kenya or here in North America?
So how did you get the idea for the climb?
I was sort of feeling guilty. I've been telling students and people that they need to volunteer, they need to fundraise, they need to get involved. And I never really ran a fundraising campaign myself, and I wanted to be able to talk the talk and walk the walk. So that was the first piece. But the second piece was the founder of Free the Children, Craig Kilberger, you know, came to me one day and he said, Spence, have you ever thought about climbing Kilimanjaro? And of course, my answer was no. Like, the farthest
that would
thing
be
that
all
I...
of us, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, but like anything with Craig Kilberger and the Kilbergers in general, they plant a seed and it grows and it grows and it grows until you can't ignore it anymore. And so I went back to him because I couldn't stop thinking about it. I said, actually, yes, I really want to do this, but there's two things. I don't want to just climb the mountain because I don't want this to be about me. Why don't we create a campaign around it and raise some money? This is going to be the hardest thing I've done in my entire life. I'm going to need my two best friends to come with me. So that's sort of where the idea came from. And then East Africa was facing one of the largest droughts they've seen in over 60 years. And suddenly these community members that had helped me now needed my help. So we came up with this campaign, Redefine Possible, to, number one, you know, climb the largest mountain in Africa to prove to the world that if I was told that I would never walk or be a functioning member of society and can climb the largest mountain in Africa, what more can we all do as individuals to start redefining our own possible? And then the second piece was to raise, you know, over $500,000 for clean water in East Africa to help offset the drought so they could focus on going to school instead.
Now, it would have been really awkward, to say the least, if you didn't make it.
And, you know, we went in with a couple mindsets. If we don't make it, then there's a lesson to be learned with that. And we bring that back and we share that. But we did make it. And it wasn't without its set of struggles. You know, we were hoping that I'd be able to do half on my hands and half in a wheelchair because I've had a previous shoulder injury. And, you know, contrary to popular belief, your arms aren't meant to be walked on. So I need to hang on to all the limbs that I've got left, so to speak. And but when we got there, I was walking about 80% of my hands and about 20% of my chair. Halfway through, our guide and my buddies were like, look, Spence, like if we're actually going to make it to the top and back down again, you're going to need to let us help you a little bit. So I sort of relinquished and let them carry me a bit here and there, still walking most of it on my own, but accepting help when I needed it. And then what was so crazy, Michelle, is the flip side of that is when we got towards the top, I didn't get altitude sickness at all, but my two buddies did. And it was really the first time in my entire life where I wished that I had legs that day.
Because your buddies were not doing well.
Yeah, and so I could be the one to carry them. But obviously that wasn't the case, so I did what I could do, and I stood in between them, and in tandem, you know, we walked slowly together until we reached the top.
You've been actually been sort of offering some words of wisdom throughout our conversation, but before we let you go, we often like to ask people, do you have any wisdom to share?
For me in particular, it goes back to my parents and how we always focused on what I could do instead of what I couldn't do. There is no can't or won't, only how.
Spencer West is a motivational speaker and author of the memoir Standing Tall, My Journey. He was kind enough to join us from Wyoming Public Radio in Laramie. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms and dads in your corner. Every week we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. Today we want to talk about public interventions into other people's parenting. And we're talking about this because it seems as though we're seeing more of this these days. A South Carolina mom was recently arrested for letting her 9-year-old daughter play alone at a park while she was at work at McDonald's. An Arizona mother faced child abuse charges for leaving her young children in a car while she attended a job interview in March. And a Chicago mom wrote a column last month about facing legal consequences for leaving her four-year-old in a car while she ran into the store to buy him some headphones. All situations were noticed by bystanders who alerted authorities, and consequences that we just told you about ensued. And reaction to these situations has ranged wildly from outrage to empathy, and it got us thinking about when it's appropriate to intervene, how to do it, if ever. So we're talking about this with a diverse group. Jolene Ivey is a mom of five boys and a Maryland state lawmaker, recently a candidate for a lieutenant governor. Jeff Yang is a Wall Street Journal columnist and father of two sons. Gail Trotter is a senior fellow at the Independent Women's Forum and a mother of six. And Felix Contreras is co-host of NPR's Alt Latino podcast and the father of two boys. Welcome back to everybody. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So let's start with that South Carolina woman's case. She worked at McDonald's, as I mentioned. Her daughter had been coming with her and playing on a laptop, but apparently the laptop was stolen and the little girl was bored. So the mom dropped her off at a park with a cell phone, and she had a key to their apartment. But apparently a passerby saw the child at the park on his or her way to work. And when she or he, I don't know if it's a man or woman, saw the child again playing sometime later without an adult present, the person called the authorities. The mom was arrested. The child has been taken into social service custody. Some very strong reactions to this. One website has endeavored to raise some funds for the mom. Apparently, they've raised about like $25,000 or so. Some critics are taking the person who reported this incident to task. But the incident was reported in the local media there as the mother abandoning the child. So I just want to ask each of you for your reaction to this. Jolene?
Severe overreaction and hints of racism.
Because?
Well, clearly in the press, when they were talking about her, they said that they specifically said a black mother, and then they said that she'd abandoned the kid. It just seems insane to me. The child wasn't abandoned, and the mother's race was not relevant. So the whole thing just seemed ridiculous to me. And instead of that busybody bystander turning her in, maybe they should have done something about helping the mom, who clearly needed a little extra help.
Felix?
I'd agree. Overreaction by the state and overreaction by people tuning in and not listening to all the facts and maybe being shaped by some of the stilted local media coverage, I think. But I also think that it wasn't out of line for the woman at the park to ask some questions and maybe move things forward.
But how would she have done that? What should she have done?
Maybe contact the mom. Follow up by contacting the mom and finding out a little bit more information, and maybe there's a way that she could help or other people could help. I mean, turning to the state, turning to the police, I don't think was the right way to handle that.
Gail?
I agree completely with the other two panelists, and I think that in this situation, this is where prosecutorial discretion would come up, or the arresting officer would have discretion as well. So there's a failure on many levels in this situation, not just of the person who called in to report the mother, but also the officers who arrested the mother and the prosecutor going forward. This is a perfect example of where charges should be dropped, and you're doing much more harm to the child by prosecuting the mother and arresting her than you are for the child to be at the park.
Is that the standard, though, you would use? Because objectively speaking, was that a safe situation? I mean, I think reasonable people could argue it was not a safe situation, notwithstanding the fact that there were lots of other kids at the park, apparently. It's a very popular location. There was no caregiver attending to her specifically. So objectively speaking, so what's the standard that should have been employed here?
Well, we all have a lot of discretion as parents because the world is a dangerous place, and we all understand that life is risky. So you just made the point that reasonable people could disagree about whether the park was safe or not, and I think that parents need to be given the discretion to decide that for their children, their child's maturity, and whether or not the location, if there are other parents looking out for her as well. And the go-to instinct is not to prosecute and jail a mother for this type of discretion that she's using, but really to give her more options and to discuss it with her. But in this case, this was completely the wrong decision to make in regard to this mother.
Jeff Yang, what do you think?
You know, it's interesting because I feel like my views on this are a little bit colored in two directions because I live in, you know, kind of a classically high intervention neighborhood, Park Slope, Brooklyn, where if you turn your back on your child, he'll be whisked away and force-fed organic kale or something. That's one side of it. The other side is that my parents are immigrants, and like many immigrant parents, they grew up in situations where a lot of the standards that we have here around how old a child should be, to be independent, to be able to move around freely, is very different. They grew up, you know, in huge families, and they were on their own, well, not really alone, but without parents for large periods of time from very young ages. And I grew up as kind of a latchkey kid. You know, age 10, 11, I was walking back from the bus to you know, the library and so forth, waiting for my parents to pick me up. In this particular case, I can't really blame the person who investigated the situation for more than perhaps overreacting in the sense of going to the authorities. I agree with the other panelists that trying to find the mother, talking to the girl and saying, where is your mother, would be a better thing than reporting to the police. It's crazy.
Because why, though? I mean, if objectively speaking, if you felt that the child's circumstances were unsafe, isn't it their job? I mean, isn't it the job of the authorities to investigate these issues? Is it your job to determine whether those circumstances are right?
I think if you take the responsibility, and it is a responsibility, to try to help somebody, then you first have to identify the full context of the situation, knowing perhaps that by reporting the authorities, there was going to be a significant consequence. It always makes sense to, even if it takes a village to raise a children, not to treat parents like village idiots, you know?
You know, Julian, I'm curious about this. And if you're just joining us, we're having a regular parenting roundtable. We're focusing on public interventions when it comes to parenting. When is it appropriate to step in? We started by talking about a South Carolina case where a woman was arrested because her daughter was playing at a nearby park while she was at work, working her shift at McDonald's. May or may not be relevant that she made sure the child had a cell phone and also was within walking distance of her apartment so she could have gone home at any time. A bystander intervened. Our guests are Felix Contreras of NPR's Alt Latino podcast, Maryland State lawmaker Jolene Ivey, conservative columnist Gail Trotter, Wall Street Journal columnist Jeff Yang, all parents. So, Jolene, you've told us before about situations where you did intervene. You know, there were... I don't remember the exact circumstances, but you've told us that, you know, you've walked up to parents and said, stop this or that. What is the trigger for you?
The child has, it's not just that I or you have to think it might be an unsafe situation, because I disagree that the world is, I don't think the world is a dangerous place, generally speaking. I know that that's not popular. The media wants us all to think that everybody's trying to snatch our children, and many of us have had moments.
I don't know that there was a meeting where we decided that, but just
well,
to let you know
I'm
that
just telling
we
you,
want
look,
you to think that, but I'm just saying.
I used to work at a television station when I was about 30 years ago, and there was this whole thing about the missing child, right? Mm-hmm. And everybody had to get their kid ID'd, the picture taken, the fingerprints. And I didn't have children, and I couldn't figure out what was this we were trying to prevent. So I asked, what do we do with this information if the child is missing? Oh, that's what we use to identify the body. Mm. Well, that is not protecting children. And so I think that, you know, you're just making it up when you try to say that people are trying to snatch your child. Most of the time, if there's been a child snatching, it's the non-custodial parent. It's not some stranger. It happens rarely.
So what's the standard for you to intervene?
That someone has to actually be hurting their child. And hurting your child isn't leaving your child in the park for a few hours. Hurting your child is hitting your child, okay? It's really being abusive physically to your child, or even screaming at your kid. And the screamers, I try to intervene in a different way because I'm trying to keep it from escalating. And if you see someone screaming at their kid and it looks like really bad, you can just go over and say, man, kids can make you crazy, can't they? Oh, he must be so tired, and poor you. You know what? And you try to intervene and talk to the kid and just break it up. I think that that's really helpful.
Felix, do you have a standard for intervening? Have you ever?
But the only time that ever happened was riding the metro here in D.C. And there was a young woman. She was two kids. It was the end of the day. She was obviously tired. And one of the kids, the older kids, maybe about 4 or 5 years old, was tired and cranky. And we all know what that's like. And he was just going on and on, you know, sort of whining and stuff. And she sort of grabbed him. And everyone in the car realized, you know, what was going on. She sort of grabbed him and shook him a little bit, you know. And there was an audible, like, people in the car were like, oh, no, you know, blah, blah, blah. So the only time I really intervened was my dad taught me how to, you know, make a quarter disappear from my hand, a little trick for kids. So I just walked over and started doing that to the kid to take his mind off of whatever, you know, he's tired and hungry. Did that for a few stops, and that sort of mellowed him out and mellowed the mom out, you know. But that's really the only time I've ever intervened in something like that.
Gail, do you have a standard for intervening? What would cause you to get involved?
My standard for intervening would be something that would necessitate a 911 call where life or limb is in danger. But I completely agree that it would be great to learn some magic tricks for those times where you don't want to intervene in a judgmental or critical way, but you want to take some of the stress, some of the pressure out of the situation. And I would say there are many times where I've done that, to go up and start singing to the child, or if you have a screaming baby, like a newborn or real young child, and the mom you just know is about, or the dad is about to tear out his hair, and you go up and they're not able to eat their dinner, you go up and offer to hold the baby for a while.
Is that welcome? Or do people tell you to mind your business?
Yes, but I think probably because people know I have so many kids that they're, you know, very trusting with me, and so when I come up, they're happy for me to help them with that. But maybe even with strangers, they see that. So I haven't had a problem with that. But the judgmental criticism should never, ever enter into that type of intervention.
Jeff, you have a story, as I understand it.
Sort of. As I mentioned, you know, Park Slope, Brooklyn, it's a place where I've actually been castigated publicly for feeding my younger son grapes that were not cut in half at a playground. So that's kind of the tenor of things. One thing which I do and have done and continue to do, I did this morning, is I ride my younger son with a helmet slowly on the sidewalk on the top tube of my bicycle to get him from place to place. He loves it. I enjoy it. We have, you know, we sing together and everything. And I have actually had somebody jump in front of the bicycle and, you know, hold up her hands saying, you cannot do that. You're going to, you know, cause an accident. Your child will, you know, risks blah, 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 you know, brain injuries, et cetera. And I was flabbergasted. I mean, I actually got off the bike and started walking with him. He started getting upset, but more just not to cause a scene. What I ultimately wanted to say was, you almost caused that accident by leaping in front of my bicycle. but that, you know, the notion of when somebody is causing harm or risking harm, it's a very, very gray area. And I do think that there isn't enough conversation or isn't enough guideline setting, I guess, around what parents should think of as being potentially a risk worthy of intervening, of getting between a parent and child.
You know, it's interesting because you wonder, the folks who were telling you not to ride your kid on the handlebars, which is something that I think a lot of people do.
Oh, not handlebars.
Handlebars. Oh, sorry.
That is actually crazy. The top tube kind of between my legs holding onto the handlebars.
Right. Yeah. It's just – is it – The bottom line for me with the question of the – I keep going back to this woman at the McDonald's, is the real issue is she had no safe place for her child. There was no child care while she was at work.
Right.
And, you know, one of the other issues with the way some of these employers work these days, what they call it just-in-time shifting, is that you don't even know when you're working until maybe a couple of hours ahead of time or 2 days ahead of time. So try to figure out how to manage child care in kind of that scenario. And so that's the part about this that I kind of find interesting. Okay, but what about the hot car thing, Jolene? What about the hot car? I mean, this is one of those issues where this woman in Chicago wrote about it. It was a 50-degree day, and the four-year-old, they were about to take a trip, and she realized that something he needed for the trip was broken, and she wanted to grab something for the trip. Somebody videotaped her license plate, and by the time she actually got to her destination, the police were kind of at her house.
Yeah, that was a little extreme, I thought. I mean, if they had stood by the car and the woman hadn't come back in a certain amount of time and you really got concerned for the child, then you go in the store and you try to find the mom and you say, hey, you may have forgotten your kids out there. But for a five-minute run inside the store, and it's not even that hot outside, and she left some windows down. I mean, I understand that a car can get really hot very fast, but that standard hadn't been met. It sounded like the woman was just wanting to cause trouble more than she wanted to help. If she'd wanted to help, she could have stopped the woman and said, hey, you want me to watch your kid for a minute so you can run into the store?
Yeah.
But just to call the cops and videotape it, not even say anything to the woman. Clearly, she was there long enough, or he or she who was doing the videotaping was there long enough, could have had that conversation.
What do you think? Because you're also a lawyer, in addition to being a commentator in MI6.
Yes.
And then is there kind of some objective standard? But when you think, I mean, the hot car story, I mean, unfortunately, is very much in the news of late, and some really terrible situations that have occurred.
Yes, and these tragedies. There was an episode a few years ago out in Manassas, Virginia, where a father, the mother was out of the country, and the father left one of the children in the car, and none of the siblings recognized it, the father didn't recognize it, and then he was prosecuted. And so the law has to deal with these very tricky situations where, as I said, I do believe the world is a dangerous place, and things can happen. Something could happen to that child in the park, even if the mother was there. We have all sorts of accidents that happen. But for me, I would never feel comfortable leaving young children alone in the car, but that's my choice. That's my decision. And for me, when I've been confronted with that, I thought it was safer to send a younger child into the grocery store to buy whatever the thing was instead of leaving the children in the car by themselves. But we should give the parents the benefit of the doubt. And when these situations happen, unless there's some evidence that the parent intended to do that, I think that we as a society need to understand the stresses of being a parent and give them compassion and assistance and not try to make them the targets of prosecutorial aggression.
So you want to give us, Jillian, a final thought on this? Why do you think we don't? Or do you have any kind of word of wisdom here to conclude this conversation? It's obviously complicated. So many different scenarios. So many different details matter. And also, like Jeff was telling us, you know, where you live sort of matters in terms of what people seem to think is okay and not okay. Final word of advice on this?
I think we all just need to be a little kinder to each other as parents and to look out for each other as much as we can. If you disagree with what somebody's doing or saying, try to intervene in the nicest possible way.
And learn some magic tricks, right?
There you go.
Thank you. Jolene Ivey is a mother of five boys and a Maryland state lawmaker. Gail Trotter is a senior fellow at the Independent Women's Forum and a mom of six. Felix Contreras is co-host of NPR's Alt Latino podcast, the father of two boys, with us from Washington, D.C. And Jeff Yang is a Wall Street Journal columnist and father of two sons, with us from our bureau in New York. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thanks, Michelle.